The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you can join us this week. And before we get started, I just want to mention that we do not sell investments. We don't promote investments. And if that's what you're looking for, you're in the wrong spot. We do, however, assist you in understanding what the relevant criteria is for taking a look at real estate private partnership syndications. And if that's an area you have an interest in, it's a pretty narrow niche. It's still seemingly one of the most lucrative investment playing fields. And but in any event, you know, it's interesting how the market ebbs and flows, the economy causes issues, the interest rates cause issues. It's just bumpy enough to where you might want to consider engaging a professional to help clarify a myriad of terms, assumptions, projections at all that will be placed in front of you as you ponder whether you might choose from A, B, C, or D, or more. And I would hope that you wouldn't let a little difficulty set aside your desires and objectives to catch up on your retirement savings. Most of the clients I have that invest in these options are seeking to build either greater retirement wealth or catch up on retirement wealth that they perceive they're behind on. And I guess I might at this point just throw out, you know, I'm curious what you think the correct amount is, or the amount that you should be targeting to live comfortably. And I'm going to identify or define comfortably as your current lifestyle, maybe better than your current lifestyle. You know, if you have any aspirational spending that will recur as you refocus into your later years, you're going to need more perhaps than what you spend now. Just depends on your situation. And you may have significant assets already, but maybe you don't want to sell the home you live in or other, you know, recreational toys, as it may be. And so you're looking at the fact that the life expectancy, if we just use the IRS tables, the life expectancy for males in today's environment is deemed to be 85 to 86 years old when you pass. And females are a little bit higher at 87 to 88 years old. So if you're the typical 65-year-old that's contemplating refocusing, you notice I don't say retiring except to explain why I use the term refocus. Retire has it seems like the connotation is you're done, you're quitting. And I know most of my clients are doing anything but quitting when they hit 65, and I can almost tell you, if you ask people in that situation that I come into contact with, they wonder what they used to do, how they used to get everything done, because they're double busy now and they don't have the 9-to-5 at the office scenario or wherever. Maybe it was their own business. And so I would say that when you refocus, you tend to take on at least as many activities as you may have had prior. And for those that travel, I know a little bit about that topic since I live in Southeast Asia. And I can tell you that sometimes I wonder, how in the world did I ever get things done before? It's hard enough now, and because the time it takes to prepare and to get all the details in place and get from wherever you're at to wherever you want to go. And I am a big advocate of part-time living abroad. And I would argue that if more Americans would do that, and I don't mean you've got to live somewhere instead of where you live now, round, year round, but there's a certain intrigue with being able to change the where you live temporarily and know that, okay, I'm not committed here for the duration. I'm here just to maybe learn about another culture or another manner of living. Maybe you want to learn different cooking styles, or maybe you want to go to sporting events that are elsewhere than where you're located. And, part-time living abroad is something you can do relatively inexpensively, certainly no more than you would spend to live full-time in America if you do it right. You got to know those locales, have to understand the relevant variables. I'm working on a website currently to assist in this regard, but it's specific to Southeast Asia. There's essentially 7 countries here that you can, as an American, you can arrive without a visa and stay anywhere from 14 days to 90 days. So if you were going to live part-time, you pick 2 or 3 of those. Maybe you stay a month in each one. And, again, the cost of living, depending on where you're at, most of Southeast Asia is going to be less than America. I mean, there are exceptions, and we'll help chronicle that as we get more of the site up. We're looking at reviewing cost of living, infrastructure, medical desirability, which you'll be pleasantly pleased, I think, at the cost and quality of medical care in assorted of the Southeast Asia market. And, I've had personal experience. I'm blown away at what we get for what we pay here, and it should be the inverse. We should get the level of care that we pay for in America but seemingly don't get compared to some of the other countries. And again, I've had personal experience, and I can tell you I had a 35-day hospital stay several years back that wouldn't have been my total cost drive out, would not have been an afternoon in a Houston or Dallas or San Antonio hospital. It was insane how inexpensive and quality care. And it was a serious event. It was a life event. As I define it, and I define life events as something that you maybe got a 50-50 chance of survival. And boy, was I glad to be here. And by the way, for those of you that are thinking, well, gee, Nathan, that's what you get for living in Southeast Asia. No, I had just spent 3 months in the U.S., and I knew something was wrong, but I was doing my best to avoid checking into a hospital in America. And thank the good Lord He got me back to Thailand, and I was very fortunate to have a quality medical team and people that understood the issue that I had. Anyway, the other thing we will be comparing on our web resource will be the cost of transportation in and around the city locales that we like, cost of education if you still have children, the infrastructure that's here and wherever here is, and the relative ease of getting to where you're living. And, you know, one thing, probably the most surprising thing I've learned, well, there's been more than one, but I'll tell you one, and I bet none of you know, or maybe you do, maybe you're smarter than I am, but Philippines has a very good reputation as an expat location, and yet it's got some real negatives simply because of the geography. I was very surprised to learn that the Philippines is made up over 7,600 islands. Pretty hard to have a number one rated subway or SkyTrain system like we do here in Bangkok, for instance, when you're spread out over that big of a, I guess you could say, a body of water. And, you know, there's certain things that just aren't feasible. On the other hand, the Philippines, almost to a person, speaks wonderful English. I mean, for sure in the cities and out in the provinces, still pretty darn good, much more so than, say, here in Thailand, where, you know, the cities are okay, not great. But I know here in Bangkok, I have no issues communicating. And, of course, you've got Google Translate these days. Which isn't much fun going back and forth, I might add. But out in the provinces, it's not quite the same as the English you'll find in the U.S. But anyway, I talk about Southeast Asia, including the aforementioned destinations, simply because, I mean, just a practical issue, if you're behind on your retirement savings, as I see it, you've got two things you can do. You can either find the money tree and pull a bunch more money in that you might need. Again, 20 years is a long time. That's a long time to be counting on. You know, even if you had $1 million in your retirement account, I mean, first of all, the way the markets work, there's no guarantee that you won't lose part of that. And your timing, you know, the frequency that you need to make withdrawals is going to chew into the income it might generate. And so, you know, the reality is, I'm going to say you need $3 to $4 million to be self-insured. And I would define self-insured as being able to accommodate some medical events, unless maybe you're like me, you've got a Medicare plan along with a G supplement. Of course, I don't have access to that when I'm here overseas, but I've got plenty of mileage points, airline points, that I could get back there in a non-critical scenario. And, again, I don't fear that event. I much prefer to know that I could have a life event like I had previously that literally costs less than an afternoon in a Houston hospital. And I think, you know, that's a good trade-off to get all the benefits and cost savings and just general convenience. The convenience factor is high in Southeast Asia, but specifically here in Bangkok. It's just amazing. So, you know, you look at the positives, and then you look at your alternative, and, you know, you're still going to collect your Social Security even when you're overseas. You may, if your spouse will be getting Social Security, that's also normal. There's no issues there. Medicare, unfortunately, does not cover you over here unless you're traveling, and it's for a very limited time. I believe it's still 60 days. And there's a dollar amount applied to that. And that's with the G supplement. That's not the basic Medicare. But in any event, so catching up on retirement savings is definitely a reason. And by the way, there's other countries, obviously, around the world. I just happen to like Southeast Asia, and Southeast Asia is, you know, nirvana for an expat in many situations that has American living style or lifestyles. You know, it's so convenient to live here. But in any event, let's see, I wanted to just wrap up. I kind of got sidetracked from my open with the disclosure or disclaimer. I want to encourage you that if you, before you sign up, understand what you're signing up for on the real estate private partnership syndications. And if you don't work with us, work with somebody that understands what PPMs, those are private placement memorandums, and operating agreements and real estate financial projections, understand what they mean, how they're constructed, whether they're rational or not, and understand what the fee drain can do to you on these transactions, and understand that you've got other options out there in the real estate multifamily business. The small multifamily market is a wonderful place to land if you know what you're doing. And if you don't, you need to partner with people that do. And you need potentially someone like us or me, MP Ross, CPAs, to help you and make sure, again, you know what you're signing up for. Because partnerships, even small partnerships, which is what I recommend for undertaking the acquisition of a small apartment building, have some incredible opportunities tax-wise that the big transactions do not, or at least not for you. They will for the sponsor or the lead partner. But what we like about the small apartment business is that the tax benefits that you would otherwise be limited on in a large, say, 250 to 500 partnership, you can unfreeze those easier at the level where maybe you've got three or four partners and they can actively participate, even remotely, as the case may be, without having to go to the property every day. You could still hire a property manager for certain tasks, and the partners can retain certain tasks, such as reviewing vendor contracts or putting out bids for quotes or vetting applications of prospective tenants or undertaking some social media marketing for the property or properties if maybe you acquire more than a couple. And you'll be amazed at what a big impact that can have on your tax liability. And in fact, it could allow you to avoid paying tax for quite a while. And it works especially well when one of the spouses is a high income wage earner and the second spouse has the time to put into the partnership that buys real estate to perform enough hours and services to achieve real estate professional. And I would strongly encourage you, especially given the inordinate fees that are being charged now for these larger syndications, take a look at the small apartment business, and I think you'll like what you see. Let's do this. We're very close to the halfway mark on today's show. Let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll be back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
I was born a Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control.
Okay, welcome back to this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we spent the first half of the show talking about part-time living abroad, specifically in Southeast Asia. And the only thing I really didn't cover was some examples of the cost of living. And I can speak firsthand for the cost in Thailand here, specifically in Bangkok, although I'm also familiar with parts of the largest province here, the Isan province up northeast Thailand, where my wife hails from. And I can tell you, you know, if you were coming over specifically to Bangkok, there are 700,000 empty condos, which you're probably thinking, well, gee, how is there anybody left in the city? Well, yeah, that's 700,000 out of maybe 2.5 million, I think, is the most recent number I've seen. But the better number, I don't care how many empty ones there are necessarily, the better number is that you can get a roughly 300 square foot studio for maybe, I don't know, $350 to $400 a month. You can get a full one bedroom, maybe 600 to 650 square feet for 600 to 700 perhaps a month. Now, you can get penthouses at the top of these towers, these high-rise towers, that are, you know, I'm trying to think, 5,000 square feet, maybe five-bedroom. You can pay $150,000 U.S. a month, if that's your choice. Wide range, and that's one thing that's fascinating about this city, is all the different socioeconomic stratas that are accommodated within this city. It's truly unique, I think. Now, again, have I lived in every big city in the world? No. In fact, I've not lived in many at all. But I can tell you that I think I started off in the number one city by when I came over here, because I have been to a few since I've been here, so it's easier to compare, like Hong Kong, Ho Chi Minh, Singapore. So I've seen enough to know that it's a pretty good deal here in Bangkok. And I've got friends that live here, Americans, and all of us keep pinching ourselves thinking, man, you know, if only more Americans knew what they could experience here, it'd be there'd be a lot more Americans here. Now, that's not necessarily what all of them want, but I will help you. If you want to come to Thailand, whether you want to come for a month and try what I'm talking about and see if it's for you, fine. I can work with you on that front. Or if you're saying, hey, Nathan, I'm sold. I want to come for I'm going to tell you the operable number of days to live abroad in most of these countries is no more than 179 days from a tax perspective, which, you know, we understand those details. A lot of the folks that help people move to this part of the world don't understand the tax rules either in America or in the country that they're in. They're more real estate focused. And I would tell you there's nothing better than part-time living abroad done smart, where you avoid the local taxes or the country's taxes for living in their country. And can definitely, and you may be thinking, well, gee, I'm not going to be working, Nathan, but I'm going to introduce you to the remittance tax that some of these countries have, where you get taxed on the money you bring in. Just like we're doing in America now. Well, we're getting taxed on money we send out in America. That was part of the OBBBA, which you may recall was Trump's big, beautiful bill back earlier in the year. But in any event, the operable time in most countries, I mean, it's going to be the length of the visa. And if you happen to have the ability, as you would here in Thailand currently, to come over two times within a 12-month period for up to 90 days without having to have a visa. You can do that on your passport and with extensions. So anyway, and that's something that while we don't practice law and we don't work with people on their visas, we have an American law firm that's here in the U.S. that we've gotten to know, and they can most assuredly assist you with the visa process if you want to have longer stays than what you would get with your passport. Let's see. I was going to mention. Oh, so cost of living. I wanted to just make it a blanket statement that I would suggest that you would live in at least Thailand from anywhere, depending on how close to the big cities you get, which is my cup of tea. I don't know. You may like living on a rice farm in any one of a number of provinces. It's my wife's dream. It's not my dream. I don't necessarily like Starbucks, but I like to live in places that have Starbucks. We've got over 200 and I think it's almost 300 now. It probably is 300 because I see them going up everywhere. And we've probably got, I don't know, several thousand 7-Elevens, which the 7-Eleven here is a much different, serves a different role than it does in America. You know, at least when I was, I don't know, I haven't been to many 7-Elevens lately in America, but we used to go there as kids and teenagers, et cetera. It was to get some breath mints or chewing gum or maybe a Coke, you know, or a bottle of Gatorade. Here, it's more of a small grocery store. And some of the restaurants that you see in Thailand will have prepared food that they sell in the 7-Elevens from some of their menu items. And I know I've got a neighbor, the wife is a doctor. She's a neurologist. The husband works special security work for the U.S. Embassy, and their main grocery store is 7-Eleven. And I just, when I found that out, it made me want to learn more. And now the more I learn about 7-Eleven, it's like, man, they're amazing. And the money they make is second to none. It's just insane, the volume of people, much of it foot traffic, depending on where you're at. And so, you know, we've got, it's learning things like that where you begin to understand some of the cultural differences. And I'm not saying it's good or it's bad. It's different. And I know we can argue the healthiness of the food or argue about that. And that's the discussion I had specifically with our neighbor, our doctor neighbor. And she acknowledged, you know, it's not the same as home cooking. On the other hand, convenience, and she tries to regulate the food as much as she can, but it's a interesting insight into the way people live. And I've seen stories, YouTube stories as an example, where Americans had come over to visit and they were talking about their trip, and they would specifically mention, we never actually ate at a restaurant. They had 7-Elevens right outside our hotel, and you can pretty much see another 7-Eleven from the one you're in many places downtown. And excuse me. And they were perfectly content to eat the hamburgers and stuff that they could get at 7-Eleven, the tuna sandwiches, the ham and cheese, and, of course, the people that work at 7-Eleven know how to, I'm going to put air quotes around, cook that food. They take care of getting it ready for you is what I'm trying to say. And it's, I don't know, it's an interesting way of living. And I don't, I mean, I still use 7-Eleven to get some Gatorade or things of that nature. I do like one of the prepared foods, and I know I'm going to hear some comments about this. And I don't know, is Sizzler even still in America? I haven't eaten at a Sizzler in America for 40 years, probably. But it's over here, and it's a big deal. It's in almost every mall. And the dish that I have loved for years, and I don't know if it's in America or not, but it's been here for years, is their celery and crab, air quotes around the crab again. It's the whitefish variety, you know, the fake crab. But it's good, and it's, as I can see, fairly healthy. And, you know, it's a $2 buy here. Great snack. And but that's the kind of stuff I'll get there. I don't get the sandwiches, things like that. But in any event, one thing I wanted to mention, since we're on the topic of refocusing, is for those of you that have solo Ks, or what I call self-directed 401 trust, you know what a fan I am of that style of retirement plan and retirement savings. And I wanted to just mention to you, I'm going to give you the global parameters here. I'm not going to break down the individual amounts to the ages involved, etc. But let's just say they're all within a few bounds of these numbers, okay? In 2026, the total contribution limits for a solo K ranges from $72,000 up to $83,250, depending on your age and compensation. This includes both employee and employer level contributions. A solo K may allow you to use a mega backdoor Roth, unlocking even more tax advantages. It's been a while since we've talked about the mega backdoor Roth, but you know, I'll just tell you generally, if you have a solo K in your company, remember the solo K, the solo means it's for a single, as the IRS defines it, a single employee retirement plan. Single employee retirement plan, which is not exactly true, because if you employ your spouse, it can you count as a single employee, you and your spouse. Each of you have the ability to receive compensation and make a contribution. And the way what a mega backdoor Roth is, it's a big daddy version of the backdoor Roth that you can do with an IRA. And essentially, if you don't qualify to make a deductible contribution, that's to either the IRA level or to the solo K, the self-directed 401 trust level. And now the limits are much different on the IRA. I don't have those in front of me. But on the 401, again, for someone my age, if my income is high enough, including the catch-up, I can go up to $83,250. 1 year. That's in 2026. So anyway, the mega backdoor Roth lets you make a contribution where you might not otherwise qualify. You can make a non-deductible contribution and then move it from non-deductible into the non-taxable side of the solo K or the 401 trust. So think of a self-directed 401 trust as a triplex if it were a rental property. You've got a pre-tax account, just like you do in the big company 401k. You've got a Roth, or after-tax is the more proper terminology, account, and you've got a non-deductible contribution account. And so you've got the ability to make the non-deductible and convert that or transfer it to the Roth side of the solo K. And if you do it fairly quickly, the odds are there will be no tax because the account earnings didn't go up, you know, right away. And again, you've got to have the income base to qualify to make that contribution. And that's also on a backdoor Roth, you're not taking a deduction for that contribution. So don't lose sight of that. But look, I'm going to tell you right now, and I've heard other people that don't explain it, I'm going to say as eloquently as I do, the fact that you can get a deduction for an IRA or a 401k, it should be illegal for our government to encourage us to make those kind of contributions when you look at the significant tax that's coming down the road. 20 years, folks, I'm going to remind you, you got another 20 plus years to live. Do you have any idea what the tax rates might be as you go through the next 20 years, given the sad condition that we're currently in at the federal fiscal level? And what a wonderful time to take a quick peek at the U.S. debt clock. I did this a little bit last week, but I want to remind for all you doubters that I'm going to say, don't think. They think, oh, Nathan, you know, it's going to be okay. It always is. Well, you know, it always has been, but I think, let's see, usdebtclock.org. It always has been, but I think we're at a point where we truly are running out of money. Now, you can argue about the success of what the tariffs will bring in. You can argue about whether we'll actually get any people in Congress that have the financial fortitude or the financial education plus the fortitude to wrangle with their associates in Congress and make systemic changes to the way the U.S. spends money. And let's see, the current U.S. national debt's $38,856,000,000, so we're almost to the $39 trillion range. Now, that's just the part, the current part that affects the current fiscal budgetary cycle. And if you go further down that chart, which, by the way, usdebtclock.org, it's an amazing statistical accumulation of the fiscal numbers related to our country, including tracking tariffs and trade deficits by the larger countries. But in any event, the total U.S. debt is over $100 trillion. I see different assumption sets that get you different numbers. But, you know, it's just, it's unbelievable. And when you look at the categories, the four largest categories of our annual, roughly, we spend, what are we spending now? It's about $7 trillion per year. You've got almost $2 trillion that's Medicare and Medicaid combined. You've got $1.6 trillion that's Social Security. You've got interest on the debt. That's the third largest category. Has been for a year now. It is $992 billion roughly. And then the defense is $931 billion. And the rest of it is assorted cost. But, you know, you think about the fact that, you know, we're still clocking along. According to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, they project for the next 10 years or more, we'll have deficits of roughly $2 trillion a year. The national debt will be up over, I believe by 2035, it's going to be somewhere in the, let's see, what was the number? It's roughly $52 trillion, I believe. It's a big number. I mean, it almost is irrelevant because it's too big to put your hands around. And unfortunately, I think everybody took a little bit of sigh of relief when Mr. Trump got elected. And I guess what I would ask you to consider is, what did the deficits do during the first Trump administration? You know, we didn't really cut anything. In fact, it was even worse. Now, you can say, well, we had to fund COVID relief, and I suppose we did, but we still spent the money we didn't have. And, you know, the bigger issue is, how are we going to make the systemic changes to our spending that reflect priorities where getting back to the notion that we can't spend more than we borrow? When I said we'll be running $2 trillion deficits for the next, however, as far as the eye can see, the CBO only goes through the next 10 years in terms of their projecting. It's not like they projected out 10 years and then said, oh, well, it's going way down. We don't need to calculate. That's just what their mandate is, to annually update the 10-year forecast. But, you know, the reality is, when you talk about a deficit, just to be clear, that means we're spending $2 trillion more than we take in. That's insane. And the real question should be, how long do we think we're going to get away with that? Because we're still able, don't ask me how, still able to sell T-bills to cover those deficits. At some point, you got to think, those that are willing to buy those T-bills, now a lot of it is other government agencies and U.S. citizenry, but, you know, you've got China holding, I forget how much, it's a lot, a trillion, I think, and a half maybe as much as $2 trillion, and you've got other sovereign wealth funds, other countries still leaning on the dollar. It's amazing. And may not continue a whole lot longer. You know, Saudi Arabia has started to accept other currencies for oil purchases. About a year ago, I believe it was, first time in a long, long time. And at some point, you know, I don't know what the better option would be, but at some point, you may find some countries saying, well, you know, we'd prefer whatever the other currencies might be. But the problem is you've still got other countries that are as bad off or worse. Japan is running a huge cumulative deficit. I want to say it's between 250 trillion. Now, this is not annual. This is cumulative. It's between 250 trillion. It was over 300 trillion, I believe, at one point, but they've brought it back down a bit. But we're in sad straits, folks. And, you know, you say, well, what do we do about it? Well, there's two levels here. What do we do as a country is we get some congresspeople that have some smarts, like Representative David Swikert, GOP for the Scottsdale area in Arizona. He's got plenty of videos on YouTube talking about this issue, complete with voluminous charts. I lost track of the number of videos. He's easily over 300 or 400 videos. And you look at what he suggests. And, you know, the problem is the longer we talk about this, the list of possible solutions gets smaller and smaller because we're running out of time. But anyway, that's what we do at the national level, at the local level, at the John Doe and Mary Smith level. We move our retirement accounts into Roth. We consider Roth conversions. And if you've got pre-tax retirement accounts, 401s, IRAs, etc., you need to be looking at Roth. And then you get into the mechanics of Roth conversions and you realize that it's based on the fair market value, key word is market, of what the assets in your accounts, your retirement accounts, consist of. And that brings us full circle back to the private partnership multifamily syndication investment style, because those allow us significant discounts to calculate the value. We may have put $100,000 into an apartment building partnership investment, and we can value that at much less than the $100,000, because when you value a private company investment, you get discounts to cost. And, for instance, you have a lack of tradability, lack of marketability, because you can't go sell that investment on a whim. And you've also got lack of majority voting control. So that gives you a nice discount. And then you've got a myriad. You know, there's probably 20 to 25 risk factors to consider on every it's identified in every PPM or private placement memorandum. If you'll look towards the first few pages, you'll see a discussion of risk factors. It's RISK. And you'll have 20 to 25 individual items that are theoretically risk that the SEC in their rules that they give syndication lawyers for drafting these documents make them disclose and consider. And those are one of the categories of the type of information I'm telling you really need to have an understanding of before you invest. Forget about the conversion. I mean, the conversion option to Roth, we love the risk factors because we don't consider the real estate syndications as being overly risky compared to the market type investments. We think, hey, housing is a standard requirement. Everybody has to have a roof over their heads. So we like the risk. Well, we're about a minute away from the end of the show. We appreciate you joining in and listening today. We hope if you have questions about either real estate investing or living in Southeast Asia or wherever, that you'll connect with us, and we'll be happy to work with you and, you know, give you some idea of what might fit your circumstances and where you might find yourself, and see if you can't take advantage of a more comfortable, more affordable retirement or refocusing, period. Okay. We'll be back here next week, same time, 7 a.m. Central Standard Time on both KSEV AM 700 and KGBC AM 1540. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. And join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Yeah.